Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the Chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, James Meek, a litigation attorney and a fan of the classics. And has delved very deeply into the Theaetetus, one of Plato's dialogues on knowledge, famous for investigating knowledge. Now, one of the backgrounds that I want to give you on that, I think which is very important is, you know, whenever you go back 2,500 years, it's good to have a little bit of context for what you're doing and what it was like at the time. Now, of course, at all times, there were some people who questioned what it meant to be knowledge, what it meant to know something, and so on, or almost all. But it was extremely rare. Now we're really quite used to it. We're used to living with the idea that maybe we really don't know anything, and so on. But the reason Socrates himself became famous, because he said, the only thing I know is that I don't know. You know, that I know that I don't know. And everybody else thinks that they know, but they don't. So, and so that's my advantage. It's my advantage that I know that I don't know. And this, Plato is trying to grasp this in this dialogue, this concept of actually increasing your confidence in what you're doing by realizing that you don't know. Now, most people push forward by saying, I know, if you ever listen to six-year-olds, you know, or politicians, you know, it's almost always the same, you know, I know what I'm doing and I have a solution, instead of, you know, a dialogue or some kind of an attempt to come to a consensus. Of course, consensus is a lot harder to work with. It's a lot harder to get things done. And that's why democracy is sloppier and so on. But the Athenians had a democracy. It probably helped, you know, for setting the stage for people to start to really ask those fundamental questions. So this is a very radical thing to say at the time that it was said. It's very taken for granted now. It's a part of the whole legacy from ancient Greece. But you should kind of remember what a radical thing it was when everyone believed whatever was said, or not everyone, but almost everybody believed whatever was said about the gods, about the afterworld in whichever culture, and very few people went from culture to culture seeing that whichever culture you went to, everyone spoke in the same authoritative tones about different things, saying that they were all true. So we didn't have that experience for most people, except for a few traders who probably became agnostic very quickly. So it's probably very useful for the discussion about knowledge, because sometimes it goes into things that we all take for granted, of course. But it wasn't taken for granted at the time that it was launched. And with that, I'd like to have James come and get started. And we're going to do, at some point, a little bit of a pretend dialogue. I'll let James lead that. James Meek.
All right, let's talk about knowledge. And how to work PowerPoint. Oh, there we go. Sappho. Now everybody knows. But you see, Plato would say that Sappho's actually in the clear. You all still don't know anything. In his dialogue, Theaetetus, Plato suggests that I can tell you something, and you're still not going to know it. I don't just mean you should really stop eating so much ice cream, or he's just not that into you. I mean actual facts that I can convey to you, and you still won't know them. Let's try these. Only the guard knows whether there's hemlock in that cup. Easy. He knows, we don't. Only the guard knows that there's hemlock in that cup. A little bit weird, but we talk like that all the time. Presumably we mean, other than all of us, only the guard knows there's hemlock in that cup. Let's try these, though. The guard knows there's hemlock in that cup, but I don't. I know there's hemlock in that cup, but you don't. If you're Plato, these might make perfect sense to you. Tonight we're going to talk about what on earth Plato could possibly mean by something like that, if he's just kidding. And also from Plato, how to prove your point by not proving your point, Socrates' favorite lawyer joke, more levels of reality than Inception in a fifth of the time. It's what happens when the man whose claim to fame is that he doesn't know anything, anything at all, tries to get the answer to a simple question. Let's watch. If I can have my dialogic partner up here. All right. Hey, Theodosius.
It's Theodotus.
Whatever. Hey, quick question. What's knowledge?
Easy. It's perception.
Not so fast. That would mean, like Protagoras said, that man is the measure of all things, because each person perceives. So anybody's perception's as good as anybody else's, including my perception that you're wrong. Try again. Go ahead.
Okay, it's true belief.
All right. Orthodoxa, a.k.a. true opinion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But no, Theodora, because check this out. An entire profession is devoted to getting true judgments without any knowledge at all, just by persuading you to believe what they want you to believe. Lawyers, the greatest representatives of wisdom, can't teach the jury to know something by hearsay in the short time before the water clock runs out.
Wait, is it that they can never know or that there isn't enough time?
Never mind that. Think about it this way. There's a crime. The jury has to decide guilt or innocence. And let's say it's something that only an eyewitness could know. The jurors aren't eyewitnesses, so they can't know. And if you were right and knowledge was true judgment, a jury in that situation could never give a true judgment, even if they said guilty and he really was guilty, because they don't know, and then there would never be any convictions. But there are convictions, so ha!
I uncritically accept all your premises and word choice and thus your conclusion.
I thought so. Earlier, I said I was the midwife of ideas. So is your idea stillbirth?
Wait, what?
Never mind. Have you got anything else?
Sure. I heard somebody say it was a true belief plus logos. Whoa, I can speak Greek.
What fool said that?
I think it was you. Didn't you tell Mano that? We read that in high school.
No idea what you're talking about, Theater Teeter. Anyway, true belief in logos, that's crazy. It doesn't even make sense. What is logos, anyway? Wait, don't answer. There are probably only, like, three definitions. Let's see if any of them work. Does it mean just whatever somebody says?
You have a right in this country to own a gun, as long as you're a sane and responsible citizen. And that's not a right the government gave you, that's a right God gave you.
Okay, no. Does it mean being able to take something apart and talk about its components or elements? I had a dream that it meant that.
Yes?
No. I know that the first syllable in Theseus's name is spelled Theta Eta. Those are its components. But I still spell your name Theta Omega Rho.
Thor? That's not my name.
Right, because I don't really know how to spell the first syllable, do I?
Or my name.
Whatever. So anyway, let's try the third definition of logos. Maybe it means being able to give an account of how something differs from every other thing. A square is the kind of rectangle where the sides are all the same. You're the Theta Eta guy who's kind of slow and has a pig nose.
Wait, now you can spell my name?
Of course I can. Anyway, would that work as a definition of knowledge, true belief, plus an account like that?
Yes, I guess.
Oh, Thetipus, where do you come up with these ideas? No? Okay, here's the problem. Take you. I say to myself, that's my young friend Thanatos. And my belief is correct.
Hmm.
So do I know you? Oh, and I can tell someone that I know you because of the Theta Eta and the pig nose. So now do I know you?
Yes.
No, the third step is just telling you something I already knew in step one, what you look like and what your name was.
So?
So it means I had to know you already. So if knowledge is true belief plus distinction, and distinction is just showing your knowledge, then knowledge is true belief plus knowledge. That and $5 will get you a latte at Starbucks. So I've gone over the three definitions of logos, and they don't work. Your ideas are all stillborn wind eggs, aren't they? Well, at least we know what knowledge isn't.
Okay, so a couple of points. A, you're a terrible midwife, aren't you? Do any of the babies ever live? And two, wind egg?
Maybe you should blame the translators for that one. It sounded profound in the original. Okay. So that was just a little bit of sample, so you've got the background for those of you who didn't reread Theodotus before coming in tonight. So what's Plato saying? Does he tell us what knowledge is? Not really. He kind of just tells us a few things that it's not. He does talk about who can know, And he also talks about how they can get to know. But there are a few issues with his analysis. For one thing, Plato never says what he believes, or at least Socrates doesn't. And we're not the only ones to notice that. Theaetetus actually says to Socrates during the dialogue, "I can't even quite see what you're getting at, whether the things you're saying are what you think yourself or whether you're just trying me out." We're limited to getting our definitions of knowledge in this dialogue from Theaetetus or from dreams or from things that people heard from other people, but never from Socrates and certainly never from Plato. The midwife analogy that he really uses, "I'm a midwife of ideas," limits us to the mother of each idea. In other words, what Theaetetus and sometimes Socrates happen to come up with during a particular conversation. Let's talk about the jury example that he uses. I'm a lawyer, so I want to talk about juries at least a little bit. First, he says that the jury can't achieve knowledge because lawyers don't teach them, they just persuade them. But then he also says they can't teach them because they don't have enough time. Well, all the time in the world shouldn't be enough if lawyers actually can't teach knowledge. It shouldn't really matter. It's like the quote from Annie Hall, "Boy, the food here is really terrible. I know, in such small portions." Second, when he asks about something that only an eyewitness can know, Socrates uses the word "know," which they've been spending the whole dialogue, which is slightly longer than the version that you just saw, trying to define. And he certainly said in this dialogue and in other dialogues, you shouldn't use a term if you don't know what it means. Here he sort of skipped ahead and asks you to assume this is something only a jury can know. Third, he implies, at least when talking about the jury, that perception is sufficient for some kinds of knowledge. But this conflicts with his rejection earlier in the dialogue of Theaetetus' first attempt at a definition, knowledge is perception. If knowledge isn't perception, what is this thing that only a jury can't know, but an eyewitness who has perception can know? Now, even if the answer is that perception is a subset and only some knowledge comes through perception, that still conflicts with what Socrates says in many other dialogues, that knowledge never comes from the senses. It only comes from the soul remembering abstract truths or definitions or forms. There's also a hitch with the way he rejects knowledge as true belief and knowledge as true belief plus logos. He says, knowledge can't just be true belief because the jury can't know, at least if you accept his hypothesis. He says, knowledge can't be true belief plus logos because the definition ends up being recursive. In other words, knowledge is an element of the definition of knowledge. But he uses one technique for one definition and another technique to refute the other definition. But he never showed that there was any recursion problem with true belief in the jury situation. And he never said that a jury that also had logos along with their true belief wouldn't have knowledge. For all we know, knowing what happened and knowing what something is are two completely different things that they've been calling by one name. If that's the case, no wonder it's so hard to define. Even with his analysis of logos, though, there's a further problem. He arbitrarily picks three definitions of logos. As you saw, there were more. The first one, the blowhard, is a kind of a straw man. And if his list of definitions of logos is not complete, then he hasn't really contradicted the idea that knowledge is true belief plus logos, an account, a definition, a something. In fact, he ignores other definitions that we know he knew about, including his own from the Meno, where he says that an idea, once it's bound fast with causal reasoning, becomes knowledge. Or the common definition, if you've taken a college philosophy class, I haven't, but I suspect they talk about this, that knowledge is a justified or warranted true belief. And presumably when Theaetetus is bringing up this idea of true belief, he doesn't just mean any belief. And when he's talking about an account, he doesn't just mean any account. There has to be some justification for it. In other words, if I believe that Plato's dead, and the reason I believe it is because my lampshade told me, that's probably not good enough. It's probably not what Theaetetus meant. It's not justified to believe it on that basis. Both of these definitions suffer from what's called the Gettier problem, or if you're French, the Gettier problem. Take it like this. I say that you're in a room, and I say it because of this. I see you through the window that you're in your room, but actually, it's your twin sister. Wait, there's more. You're actually in the room. You were lying down. I couldn't see you. I only saw your sister. Now, we might say that I have a belief that you're in the room, that the belief is true, you are in the room, and that I have a warrant for thinking that you're in the room, namely that I saw you through the window. But we would probably say that I still don't know that you're in the room. Another definition that folks have tried is apprehending the truth. I didn't really know you were in the room because I didn't see what was true. What I saw was something that I thought was you, but was not you. Had I apprehended the truth, I'd have knowledge. Now, apprehending truth, true belief, plus logos, warranted, justified, all of these rely on the word truth. Without answering the question, what is truth? Or at a minimum, how do we know when we've got truth? In our hypotheticals, like the looking through the window into the room or talking about something and only an eyewitness can know, we have the benefit of being able to just arbitrarily say that something is true. And if somebody doesn't get the truth, then they don't have knowledge. But in real life, we never have any means by which to know whether what we think is actually true, or on another level, if what we think is true is true. Especially if the definition of knowledge contains truth, how can we ever know truth? We either end up with an infinite regress. It's true because you told me it's true, and you told me because she told you, and somebody else told her, on and on and on. Or we get recursion. Knowledge requires truth, but you have to know that it's true, which means that that knowledge has to be true, and around in a circle. Let's talk about recursion first. Socrates actually uses a similar argument about recursion when he's talking about the third definition of logos, differentiation. Telling how something is different from everything else, the pig nose, the theta eta. And he says, knowledge can't mean something plus knowledge. But then Socrates makes a similar error when he's arguing against knowledge is perception. He says, okay, all perception is knowledge. I perceive your theory's wrong. Therefore, I know it's wrong. Therefore, it is wrong. Therefore, knowledge doesn't equal perception. This is kind of like jumping up a level, or a snake eating its own tail, coming back around, or like the sentence on the screen. Or if I tell you, all lawyers lie. Some would say that you can't use a system to make statements about the system itself. You need something on a different level, a meta level, to be able to do that. And this may be sort of an endemic problem with trying to know knowledge, or at least using truth in defining knowledge. Truth by itself always presents the problem of infinite regression. It's a basic problem with truth or objective reality, which Plato definitely believes in, and Protagoras, man is the measure of all things, definitely doesn't, is that you need to show something is true. You need to have a basis for saying that something's true. But of course, that basis needs to be true, and so it may need a basis, and so on and so on and so on, which leads to infinity. It's like the conversation between the metaphysician and the scientist. The earth rests on the back of a turtle. Oh yeah, well what's below that? You think you're so clever, but it's turtles all the way down. Or the following. If, like me, you ever played with the basic programming language on a computer, if you enter that into a computer and you hit run, it's going to go on forever, and there's nothing in the program itself that can stop it from repeating. It goes back, and it goes back, and it goes back. And Jack's back. You need something outside, external to the system, that allows you to stop the program. You need something like Harry Truman's sign on your desk in order to stop the infinite regression. In other dialogues, Plato seemed to think that he'd found the sign that would stop it, the escape key. It was the forms. These were the root of all reality. Everything that we perceived were shadows. Truth starts with the forms, and I guess you're just not supposed to ask the obvious question, well, where did they come from? For him, that's the beginning. His pupil Aristotle used a similar theory, the prime mover, or the original cause. It began everything. Nothing had to begin it, and you can trace back any cause to the prime mover. Christians adopted a couple of things here. Orthodoxa, they turned into the word orthodox to describe their true beliefs. And, of course, since that includes the word true, they also needed a remedy for the infinite regression problem. And they also adopted Aristotle's prime mover in the form of God as the thing that started everything and before which you don't have to look behind the curtain and find out what started that. Now, maybe what seems infinite isn't. Maybe instead of this linear progression all the way back either to infinity or a prime mover, it's more like a crossword puzzle, where with each word that you put in, you're narrowing the remaining possible choices, and truth starts to emerge from a web of interconnectedness. Or maybe it is linear, but it's non-Euclidean. If you draw a line around a globe, it may go on indefinitely, but not infinitely. In other words, you're going to end up right back where you started. Lines that are parallel at the equator will intersect at either of the poles. Or maybe truth is something that only emerges between levels. You can't tell if your own opinion is true or maybe even justified, but you may be able to be the arbiter of truth for someone a level below you. A jury, for example, decides for the parties in a case what's true, but the jury doesn't necessarily know what's true. The jury only forms a justified belief, not truth, and so there's no Gettier problem with perceiving something but being wrong, ha-ha, it's actually her twin sister. They either form a justified belief or they don't. The jury may not have access to truth from what the parties say, because just because the two parties say something, it could be what one party says, what the other party says, or neither. They say when two witnesses tell conflicting stories, all you really know is that at least one of them is lying. Maybe they both are. Maybe they're both wrong. The jury isn't deciding what happened. They're applying a standard of proof. One party has the burden, and if the party doesn't make their burden, the presumption is the other side wins. People use that to explain the O.J. Simpson trials. So there were two trials. The first trial was the criminal trial. And in that, presumably the jury found that the prosecution did not prove that he killed his wife beyond a reasonable doubt. Later, there was a civil trial. And presumably the jury in that case found that this was a civil case. The standard is more likely than not. Presumably the jury found there it was more likely than not. The plaintiffs there, who were after money in that case rather than a conviction, proved that it was more likely than not that he did it. Now, according to this theory, it could have been the same jury in both cases. Say they, for example, say on this chart, the middle column, maybe both juries believed it was almost 60% sure that he killed them. Well, that's more than the 51% you need to tip the balance in a civil case, but not enough to be whatever the heck beyond a reasonable doubt is. Now, that's a fairly mechanistic interpretation of how juries actually apply things. And despite the efforts of lawyers and judges, I suspect that most jurors on a jury are actually trying to ascertain truth. They really want to know what actually happened. They don't say, I'm sure the light was green, but did the prosecution prove it was green beyond a reasonable doubt? In fact, I think they're uncomfortable rendering a verdict when they're not sure what the truth is and are more likely to deadlock or hang rather than base a verdict solely on did this party meet this burden and shift the presumption of innocence to guilt, for example. The appeals process, I think, recognizes this. When a trial by jury gets sent up to a court of appeal, the court of appeal never says, yep, the jury got it right. What they'll do is they will uphold the jury's verdict unless it can be shown that the jury's verdict was clearly wrong. You can prove them wrong, but you're never going to prove them right, and the court of appeal doesn't even try to prove that. Sometimes in the course of writing opinions, the court of appeal will mention that juries are just really better at finding truth and assessing credibility. But I don't buy it. I think what they're actually doing by making sure that the juries are the ones who are making the truth findings is that they're acknowledging the problem with ever finding truth. Even if those Court of Appeal judges had sat in on the trial, in other words, and heard everything that the jurors heard, they wouldn't necessarily be any worse at knowing truth, and in fact, none of them would know what the truth is. They would attempt to form a justification for their belief about the truth, but that's about all they would get. Indeed, when the Court of Appeal is reviewing a jury's opinion, they don't even attempt to find out the truth about the jury, much less the case. Here's what I mean. The Court of Appeal doesn't try to determine, did this jury in fact apply the burden and the presumptions and the standard of proof? They say, could a jury looking at those same facts that was applying the burden, the standard, the presumptions, could a jury like that have arrived at that decision? So they're not even trying to ascertain the truth about the jury. They're applying their own standard to do that. But that the Court of Appeal ends up serving as the truth arbiter, so we could say, for the jury, just as the jury serves as the truth arbiter for the parties in the case. The jury ends up not with knowledge, but just a justified belief based on what they've seen. And as I said, they serve as the arbiter of truth for the parties. And in a sense, they're supplying the T in the equation that we've looked at for knowledge equals. If knowledge equals true belief plus a justification, well, probably each party comes in with a belief, and they each have a justification. If you think about two conflicting eyewitnesses, they both have a belief, and they probably both have a justification for their belief, assuming that they're not lying in this particular instance. And what the jury does is it adds the truth. And so, you know, the winner in the criminal case who gets off, who doesn't have to go to prison, knows that she's innocent because she's got her justified belief and has been given truth by the jury, who decides what actually happened for purposes of the parties. Now, Plato may recognize some of this more than he's initially letting on in the dialogue. Socrates asks Theaetetus to assume that there are these things that only an eyewitness could know. And that's a really big assumption. And there's never any discussion in the dialogue about whether that's possible, whether there really are things that only eyewitnesses could know and that couldn't get transferred to a jury. Socrates may not even think there is such a thing. Perhaps he's just asking Theaetetus to assume that if there were such a kind of knowledge, could you still get verdicts? And if you could, then maybe orthodoxa is not the right word or definition to use for truth. But there's probably a bit of wordplay going on here. Theaetetus says knowledge equals true belief, and in Greek it's orthodoxa. Socrates then presents a hypothetical and then says in that situation, the situation where there's something only an eyewitness could know, could the jury still render an orthodoxa? But in that context, what the jury's doing probably is better translated as just verdict than true belief. Even though it's the same Greek words, it's two different meanings. Juries don't really need to form a true belief to get to a just verdict. In Greece, as now, if they apply the correct burden and the correct standard, they've rendered a just verdict, even if they're wrong. If they convict someone who didn't do it, it's a just verdict. If they let off someone who did do it, but they applied all of the standards that they're supposed to, it's a just verdict, even though clearly in both of those situations they don't have a true belief. In other words, orthodoxa is a term of art in the trial for a just verdict, but it also has an ordinary meaning of true belief. Socrates tries to use the former to refute the latter, pretending, I think slyly, that he doesn't know that one is a term of art. He also talks about not being able to gain knowledge from hearsay. This suggests that he's actually not talking about the jury listening to witnesses. Hearsay, in broad brush, is telling what somebody said before the trial when you're trying to prove that what they said is true. Confessions, for example, despite what TV would have you believe, generally don't happen from somebody breaking down on the stand during the trial and confessing. It's that they confessed sometime before the trial and somebody else is coming in and telling it. As you've probably also guessed from the fact that confessions still come in and people still get convictions, just because something is called hearsay, like that confession, doesn't mean it won't come in at the trial. There are a ton of exceptions, which is why many of them will come in. Now, Trials in Ancient Athens, something that bears on this issue of hearsay, were mostly, in fact predominantly, lawyers talking. They would occasionally bring a witness up to corroborate what they said, yep, he got it right, or occasionally actually tell their side of the story, but mostly they were just parroting what the lawyers had already said. Most of the trial was lawyers yammering, thus the water clock that had to cut the lawyers off. Now, what the lawyers say when they're telling what happened, they're telling generally what someone told them before the trial, what the witnesses told them before the trial. What the lawyers are saying is hearsay. Today, we have a jury instruction when jurors come in to sit at a trial that specifically says what the lawyers say isn't evidence. In ancient Athens, they used the hearsay rule for a similar purpose. Lawyers couldn't just get up there and tell what happened based on things that they had heard from the witnesses. They needed to bring the witnesses in. So if Socrates is saying that one of the reasons the jury can't know is because it's through hearsay, he's not talking about eyewitnesses, because eyewitnesses aren't giving hearsay. They're talking about things right now that they saw earlier. Okay, no viruses. He's actually talking about the lawyers. The comment about that he makes about the water clock actually seems to support this. He says that another reason that the jury can't know is because there's not enough time before the water clock runs out. And we know from other sources that the water clock, as I said, is there for the lawyers, and they would actually stop it. They would plug up the hole when the witnesses were coming up to actually give their testimony. So as long as they took, the water clock was stopped and it wouldn't go away. So if Socrates is saying you can't know because of the water clock, he's not saying it because of the witnesses. He's saying it's because of the attorneys. So it looks as if Plato is not saying that juries can't know, or that if I tell you something, you won't know it. And so Sappho's secret really is out, unfortunately. To find out more about what Plato's actually doing, though, we can look at, I think, what Plato and Socrates do in this dialogue, because I think it tells us more about knowledge than what Plato and Socrates explicitly say in the dialogue. Plato seems to assume, especially in his early dialogues, that the way to test if someone knows something, knows what something is to get the kind of differentiation style account that they use when they're discussing the third definition of logos. In other words, knowledge is true belief plus distinguishing something from everything else. Socrates poo-poos that in this dialogue, but elsewhere, that's exactly what Plato does. He does it for piety in Euthyphro. He does it for justice in Crito. Interestingly, though, not only does he fail in both of those dialogues and a number of other dialogues to actually come up with a definition, but when it comes time in the Theaetetus to actually defend this practice, this is how you get at knowledge by seeking a differentiation, he can't do it. Now, if differentiation doesn't work, it seems like Socrates' whole MO is shot. Everything that he's trying to do in these dialogues doesn't work. Is Plato really saying that you can't define anything? If so, maybe these first dialogues, he's actually making a parody of probably the sophists who make facile attempts to come to knowledge or truth by doing these differentiation style definitions. Maybe all he's doing in this and the other dialogues is trying to disabuse arrogant youngsters of their belief that they know something when they actually don't know anything. In that sense, he's not just delivering ideas as a midwife. He's delivering these people from their bad ideas. Maybe he's pointing out that the method that you use to test knowledge can't be the way that you arrive at knowledge. In other words, you can use logic to disprove something, which is part of why we love cross-examination, because you're trying to disprove what a witness says. But maybe we can't use logic to prove something that's true. Plato may have prefigured, in that sense, Karl Popper, who says that scientific knowledge only comes from falsifying and never from proving something to be true. Now, if all that's true, how do we ever obtain knowledge? Perhaps Plato wants to refute logic, the adversary process, maybe even dialogues in general, as a means of acquiring knowledge, because he's come to believe that knowledge has to come from the forms, accessed through the soul, by means of memory, of things that you've known since you were born. If he really buys into that, doesn't he have to say that you can't skip over the forms and just have an argument with somebody and find truth that way? So the failure in those other dialogues and at the end of this dialogue, notice they don't come up with a definition of knowledge, maybe that failure is an intentional conundrum in order to make the reader reach out for some stable source of truth and knowledge. Now, in particular, the setup for this dialogue, which we didn't do in our 4.5-minute version, might tell us something about what Plato thinks about the possibility of gaining knowledge from other people. He begins the dialogue, one of the dialogues in which Plato's not a character himself, with a character named Euclides. Euclides is talking to somebody because Theaetetus has recently died. And it reminds Euclides of a time that Socrates told him about a conversation that Socrates had had with Theaetetus. Euclides took Socrates' version of that dialogue and wrote it down into a book. And he says, oh, let me go get that book. No. Slave, why don't you go get that book? And so the slave goes and gets Euclides' book, and while they recline, a different world, the slave reads to them from Euclides' book. And in fact, the whole rest of the dialogue, the entire substance of the dialogue, is the slave reading from that book. We don't come back out of that reality toward the end. And so we have multiple levels of reality that we're coming from, all the way from the dialogue we're reading by Plato, all the way down to the book that's being read to them. We get the most levels when we get to the Protagoras quote, man is the measure of all things. And in looking it up, I realized that that's actually the earliest and closest to contemporary source we have for Protagoras saying man is the measure of all things. There isn't anybody, they overlapped lifetimes by about 7 years, but everybody else that wrote about Protagoras wrote hundreds of years later. And so the best and closest account we have of what Protagoras says is buried beneath all of these levels. It reminds me of the nursery rhyme, "This is the house that Jack built." By the time you get all the way from Plato at the top down to Protagoras's quote at the bottom. And note that there may be even one more level. Because Plato wasn't a character in this dialogue, if we assume that Plato didn't just make up the entire dialogue out of whole cloth, then at some point somebody had to tell Plato about this conversation where Euclides had his slave read the book. And so there would be yet another level. Now, these levels being in here are not an accident. Toward the beginning, before the slave starts reading from the book, Plato has Euclides explain how he wrote the book, and he made certain choices. He decided not to put in, you know, how Socrates was telling him about the dialogue. And instead, Euclides decided he was just going to pretend like he was there. And he left out things like, and then Socrates said, and then Theaetetus said, to make it seem more realistic. Now, of course, these are the exact same narrative choices that Plato makes in nearly every dialogue that he's done, including this one. In most of them, Plato writes as if we're right there. You're reading a dialogue, and even if Plato's not a character, you're right there, and it's just those people talking. And here, he leaves in all of these intermediate layers that really provide a lot of distance between you, the reader, and the speakers that are talking. Why? Now, one thought is he's doing that. He's spelling out to make you confront some of the questions about reliability when you attempt to get knowledge from another source. In other words, is this just a huge game of telephone? If jurors can't get knowledge from even a single layer of hearsay, the lawyers telling what the witnesses told them, then how are we to get from Theaetetus through Socrates, through Euclides, through the slave reading the book, and then somehow to Plato, and through Plato to us, any knowledge? Or is Plato only providing the illusion of levels? Of course, he's written this dialogue, and he's actually writing the levels in place. And so as opposed to this multiple-level dialogue, you may want to read it as just a flat dialogue that he's presenting. It's all Plato. There are no levels. They're all his characters, and the levels are only in his head. In this sense, the dialogue is there just to give you its own example of the potential for infinite regression. It's as if Plato is shoving in the reader's face the thought, you are being told a story. He's willing to go to the length of even critiquing his own preferred format, the dialogue, in order to force the reader to grapple directly with the problems in constructing a real meaning for knowledge or for truth.
We'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that we're listening to James Mink at the Commonwealth Club speaking about Plato's Theaetetus, one of his dialogues. I'd like to move back just before questions to what I introduced this with. I think it's really good to have all those convolutions that James was talking about, all the levels of knowledge and everything, to now go back to a time when knowledge was sort of absolute to almost everybody. And Plato had an agenda. And what was his agenda? I think just as you wrapped up, his agenda was that he thought there was a way to get knowledge, which was through these forms. And one of the analogies I often use is that if you're the first amphibian, walking out of the water and getting up onto the land, you're still going to be wet, when you get on the land. And Plato has a lot of mystical, semi-mystical ideas, but he also set the start along with Pythagoras, one of his favorite earlier philosophers, to getting science going.
I thought you were going to say Plato was all wet.
No. but basically, the mystical part of it is something that we're not quite accustomed to at this point, after all these centuries. And basically, what was Plato trying to get? I mean, his idea about the forms is that they were this divine perfection, unchanging perfection, and that all of our shadows, the shadows of this world, are imperfect copies of that, and we're all not so good, but the forms are really wonderful and divine and so on. And what was he really talking about is a form of knowledge which we call concepts. Concepts. What are the patterns between what we see? A scientific law is the pattern in the way that certain material behaves. And there's major principles, major concepts, and there's minor concepts, how some things work, but we're very, very accustomed to this idea of a concept, an abstract idea that explains what the pattern is and how we see things. We can even have concepts that describe our minds and how they work, so on. But for Plato, in order to try to sell the idea, it was a divine, huge thing, and as I say, I think that's part of his being wet. We are really quite accustomed to this abstract concept idea. And if that is where knowledge lies, if that is where substantial, unchanging knowledge lies, it's a big shift away from where unchanging, divine knowledge used to lie. And, of course, that's also a very big risk to take. So you put a lot of levels in, to your dialogue to have plausible deniability. I think that's one of the contexts, I think. We've been so used to this for so many centuries that we take the concept as a very natural and normal thing, and we don't make it divine or anything. It's just the way things are. So, questions. Who has the first question? Who'd like to delve into knowledge a little more?
I have a question. One of the things that came up for me is how, for human beings, there's a real tendency that once we are convinced of something, I've watched documentaries about jury trials that have taken place, and they've convicted people, and then later on DNA testing proved that the person was innocent, and people still refuse to believe that, even though it was clear evidence, but they refuse to believe or change their minds that it was still not that person that was guilty in some way. So how does that relate to this? I mean, how does our human condition and our perceptions about what truth is and how important it is for us to feel right once we make up our mind, how does that play into all this, or does it?
For me, my immediate reaction to it is that's sort of the ignored truth problem. I mean, just as these guys, when they're talking about what knowledge is, sort of skim over what it means to know truth, some of us realize that we don't know truth, but all of us, I think, end up substituting justified belief and treating justified belief as if it's true, and then the longer it's held and maybe the more often it's recalled, it solidifies into this thing that gets treated like truth, even when confronted with other, as you say, actual facts.
Than not. I mean, it's part of our human makeup for some reason. It's some sort of genetic part of us to be right. I mean, it must have something to do with, you know, I have no idea. But it really is a hindrance. I mean, this world is full of a lot of illusion just based on people needing to be right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think certainly what you say explains the phenomenon I was talking about of jurors not wanting to just apply burdens and presumptions, but wanting to actually go for truth. And so, you know, certainly I think if juries were actually saying, yes, I think in this case we've gotten to 60% proof or whatever, if they were able to hold on to that mindset, which I think few among us would be able to do, but if they were able to, the new evidence would just be, oh, well, that new evidence actually tips the balance and I no longer believe it to be true because my justification has changed. But you know, I think, as you say, we're not either willing or able to operate on that basis. We want something to be true, and once you've decided it's true, you're not going to turn back on it. I mean, look at Plato. He kept up that form stuff forever, and totally, totally crazy.
Well, Socrates, as many of you know, had a jury trial himself, in which the true belief was found that he was, you know, violating the precepts of the gods or whatever, or leading the children astray in the community, and he was found guilty and forced to drink hemlock. He was also allowed to walk away if he'd wanted to, and escape, but he didn't want to do that for several principles. But this jury trial that he underwent, they undoubtedly, the jury, believed that he was doing this. And maybe he didn't do what they said he did, because he didn't really attack the gods directly too often, but he did exactly what you're talking about all the time, which was to confront people and make them feel that they weren't right all the time, and showing them how they weren't right, and making them feel confused anyway as to, you know, maybe the next morning when they woke up they said, no, I'm right, and I don't know how he confused me, you know, and therefore he's wrong, and I don't know what kind of parlor trick he's playing to confuse me, but I know I'm right, and therefore he's got to go because he's causing problems. And I think that the jury and the prosecutors were felt justified in what they did, and I think that there are other people at many times in history who said, yeah, they were justified. That's what he did. He undercut a fundamental idea that we had, which is that we're right all the time, which, you know, justifiably should be undercut, but that doesn't mean it wants to be heard. A related idea, which I think is very fascinating, is that a lot of prosecutors are eventually convicted of having planted evidence or used information sort of inaccurately or hidden evidence that was, you know, might lead towards the lack of a conviction because they believed so strongly in what they believed about this event. And, you know, I'll bet more than half the time they probably believed correctly about it and just didn't have enough evidence and knew what the game was and had to put the evidence in that would make what they knew was true in a different way come out. But, of course, a lot of times they do it in error as well because of their belief that they were right. Mm-hmm. So it's a fascinating part of how we do it. And you ask, you know, why do we always think we're right? I think it goes right back to this, the same thing with Socrates asking the question. We live our whole lives based on our assumptions that we have about life. And it's the most uncomfortable thing in the world, just about, to have those ideas, those assumptions knocked aside or dismissed or said, that really doesn't add up. Are you sure you should have made those decisions for the last 65 years of your life? Nobody wants to hear this, especially after they've lived their whole lives. That's why it's popular in college when it's a fun time to dismiss the assumptions you were given in childhood and to start moving on. And how popular this attempt to look at your basic assumptions is outside of the college years, I think is very indicative of how rarely we really want this. And I think this is actually a sign of somebody who really loves wisdom, really is a philosopher, that they are made happy by somebody's knocking an assumption so effectively that it knocks that assumption out. Because then they really don't believe in their assumptions. They only hold to them as orthodoxy with something to hold them down. And then as soon as they have a better argument, they're going to buy that better argument because that's what they want. They're not embarrassed by being wrong. They're embarrassed by dismissing a good argument, even though they've heard it. one of the things that lawyers are trained in and actually makes lawyers fairly interesting to work with, is that you can give a good argument, especially in front of a large number of other people. And if that person has been bluffing or pushing or something like that in a negotiation or a litigation, and you come up with a logical argument based on facts that's supported and so on, it's very hard, given their training, for them to dismiss that. They often say, okay, I'll grant you that, but, and then move on to something else. But it's very hard. And whereas a lot of other people don't have any trouble, oh, you're just talking nonsense and moving on. Because there's no training on that line. So, next question.
Now, a lot of us, or most people, think that there are true things and false things, but my professor at university said that that's the wrong way to look at things. All we really have are probability distributions. And the things that we consider to be true are just probability distributions that have very little spread in them, while the things that we really don't think we know about, like whether Milwaukee, Wisconsin has more people or fewer people than Kansas City, Missouri, which I doubt anyone in this room knows, either way, or something where we're just kind of 50-50. And he said every time you get new information, that transforms your probability distribution in some fashion. If the information seems to indicate the person's guilty, your thoughts of his guilt narrow, and if you think it's someone saw him miles away from the murder, then suddenly your belief in his guilt, your probability distribution moves to innocence. Now, the name usually given to this way of thinking is Bayesian theories, and in order to transform your probability distribution, you do need Bayes' theorem, and that wasn't discovered until the 18th century. But is there anything in Plato where Socrates has this idea that, in fact, knowledge is more of a probability distribution than, that does contradict forms, I guess, but it's not out of line with what he was saying in this dialogue.
I'm going to defer to you on that one. I mean, he certainly doesn't mind taking the devil's advocate position and speaking out against forms.
Right.
I'm just trying to think if there's...
And that one of the interesting things that informs the dialogues, I think, and that scholars have argued about for a long time, is how much of Socrates was Socrates and how much was Plato. And I think it's been relatively, on the probability curve distribution, is a fairly narrow thing, that the forms is an idea that Plato had, not Socrates, that this idea about this divine imagery and so on, that Plato... had his ideas midwife by Socrates, that Socrates was really the arguer, the discusser, the technique of using this method, but I don't know anything. He was that guy. But Plato is clearly not a person who thinks he doesn't know anything. He thinks he knows something. He knows a few big ideas, and he wants to share them. And one of the things he knows, for example, or at least thinks he knows, is that he can ignore Socrates telling him not to write anything down. Because Socrates and most of the people of that time and earlier said, don't write anything down. It's a very bad way of passing on information to the next generation. Plato obviously ignored that completely. And we're lucky that something got passed. Now, probably we didn't get all the information that we would have been if we'd been there, but we weren't there. So I think there's a good way of discriminating between what was Plato and what was Socrates. But I think that's part of the tension in a lot of dialogue, because Plato almost never puts himself into the dialogue until the final dialogue. There's a few dialogues near the end of when the probability curve of where these dialogues come in time. There's a few dialogues near the end, but not at the end, where Plato takes a couple of very minor pot shots at Socrates' personality. And then after that time, he stops using Socrates, or he uses somebody else, like in the Statesman. Or in the Laws, he doesn't use Socrates. So, I think it's an interesting part of any student that has such a teacher, extracting himself from the total influence. But it took a long, long time.
I mean, I guess one thought is I suspect, in answer to your question, that Plato and I guess through Socrates, I can't think of anything in Xenophon, Socrates that answers this. But so through Plato, I don't think he ever would have done the probability distribution, just because probability distribution ends up being a substitute for truth in the definition. And at least from what I've seen, and I definitely was looked, to the extent I was looking at the other dialogues for this, I was looking for, you know, how did they, what did they do about truth? And he always seems to treat truth as this absolute thing that exists. And you may have lesser or greater access to it, but I don't think there was ever any questioning that there was truth, whereas it's kind of a radical thing to say, well, since we can't actually know truth, what we know is later, lesser or greater probability. So I suspect we wouldn't find it anywhere with him, and that it would be, you know, a lot more modern.
That's correct. I mean, there's no question that Plato believed in an absolute truth, the good and the forms, and being a part of that. And so, therefore, he would not have approached it as a probability. But I think he'd be in total agreement, and I don't think it's too far off of the theory, that what we perceive, what human beings in the shadows are looking at is, you know, more or less, you know, substantial, believable ideas that we have. Some of our ideas are much less believable than other ones. And some of the, you know, one of the things he really didn't like, which, of course, was much later, and what was what Socrates got in trouble for, was Plato really didn't accept the Homeric mythology about the gods. And his argument was very different from a lot of the other ones. It wasn't that it was, you know, incapable of belief that Zeus and the gods all did the things that they did. It was that they weren't good enough, that their personalities were insufficient to be called divine and by their behavior. And therefore, this is not something that we should believe in. So he took a high-end argument against it, something that the Catholic Church really enjoyed. Plato was one of the few, Plato and a few of the other ancient Greeks, some of the few people from prior to 0 BC who have been given any place whatsoever in the theology of any Christian religion. But mostly they're relegated as was done in Dante's Divine Comedy. They're put in purgatory, essentially. The highest rung of purgatory. You can't go to heaven because you're not a Christian, but we have a nice calm place where all of Virgil and Plato and Aristotle, they all hang out and talk to each other, and it's not too bad, but you don't get to go to heaven. And it's kind of funny because Dante has a little bit of longing to be there himself, although he knows he's not supposed to want to stop there. Other questions? We have time for one more question. Anybody else? Just a second. Anybody else? Okay.
I'd like to continue what she said.
Okay.
This thing about being right, it must have some kind of survival value, as in the plant is poisonous and the snake is poisonous, that kind of thing. That's really in our DNA. And that kind of survival value belief system that is stuck in us has been transferred into believing in concepts or ideas that may or may not be true, but we act as if they are, as in my culture is right and yours is wrong, my God is right and yours is wrong, and then we go to war and fight about it. So knowledge has come down to just being beliefs about whatever it is that we're taught to believe. Does that make sense?
I mean, I think the first part of it, it seems almost like our model for knowledge is the food poisoning model. Yeah. That thing made me sick, I think, because I ate it and then I got sick, and therefore I know it, and viscerally I will never eat that again because I'm pretty sure it made me sick. If that's the origin of how we come to have convictions, then, yeah, we have our convictions at this visceral level and sort of overestimate, if it's a probability thing, we overestimate the probability of our being correct on any given thing out of the thought that it's too risky not to.
I think if you look at animal behavior, you'll see exactly the same attitude. The animals almost all think they're right all the time. So I'll end with Mark Twain, and he said, the problem with the, you know, sitting on a hot stove for a cat is not that the cat learns to not sit on a hot stove. It's that it also learns to not sit on a cold stove. So that's it for tonight. Thank you very much, James.
Thank you.
It's probably a good thing you didn't take a college philosophy course, or the professor would have been intimidated.
sure.
We also thank our audience here at the club, as well as those listening on the radio and online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.